Welcome. Thanks for joining me, Lana, along with Rachel Summers, who's an author and holds degrees in history, comparative religions, English, literature, and philosophy. In her first ever interview, we'll talk about her novels and compare today's puritanical liberals to the Inquisition and witch hunters of old. And Rachel points to the Nuremberg trials as another witch hunt that used torture as a confession method. When it comes to religion and spirituality, pro-whites are a diverse bunch, with practices ranging from paganism to Christians and atheists, transhumanists, and even Satanists and Luciferians. We'll talk about some of these groups, so stick around. Welcome, Rachel Summers. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, since you're a new face, tell us a bit about your background. Who are you?
I am attempting to be a writer. I guess you could call me a dropout philosopher. That's what a lot of people have called me. I was supposed to get a PhD in philosophy. It didn't quite work out that way. So I decided to write novels instead. And that's what I'm currently doing. I also write for a couple of different websites.
Yeah, I also heard that your dissertation proposal was rejected, something that might have caused a scandal. So tell us about what happened there.
I was negotiating with a couple of very prestigious institutions that I won't name because the professors were actually really nice to me. And they told me that my dissertation proposal would cause the check signing alumni to sign less checks if they knew what I was up to. So they tried to get me to change my mind and do all these other things with Professor so-and-so is doing this. You could do your dissertation on that and whatnot. And I said, no, I'm going to do it my way. And I left and started writing books.
Now, what was a dissertation going to be about?
In a nutshell, witches, whores, heretics, dissenters, outlaws, and rebels, and how they are the backbone of society, as opposed to quote-unquote normal people. They didn't want to hear it, so I left, and I actually went to a motorcycle mechanic school for a year and got a job in a Harley shop, and that's where I wrote my first book.
Yeah, was there other women working there, or were you one of the few?
I was one of the few. There were a few girls in the clothing department, but I wasn't in the clothing department. I was in the garage. So, yeah, that was different.
So who are some of your favorite philosophers and thinkers?
How long do we have? Let's see. I guess I started with Nietzsche back in high school. I went to a really small conservative Christian schools, and they told us not to read this guy because he said God is dead. So, of course, I'm like, I got to get all his books.
Of course.
And, yeah. So I started with him and moved on to 20th century French existentialists. And they're great writers. They have great stories, but their politics and their social views I don't quite agree with. But with any thinker, you have to take the good stuff and just leave the rest and move on. I guess the Romantic Satanists are also an influence on me. You've got poets like Baudelaire, Le Comte de Lautréamont, Barbusse, Rimbaud, etc. And Percy and Shelley would also be in that group as well. Byron and Shelley, excuse me. They were a big influence on me. And moving into more modern times, Russell Jacoby, he's my go-to guy for academic criticism. You got Spengler and Hayek, who did some rather prescient warnings to the Western world. Those are great books. David Irving, I like a lot. He's a very brave scholar. He's done a lot of World War II revisionism. He's been a big influence on me. Really, there's far too many people to name.
There's some good ones there, and I definitely want to get into the...
I have a large book collection.
Yeah, you've used the term ivory tower often, and you wrote a couple articles for the revolutionary conservative Augustus's new website. So what do you mean by ivory tower?
That is a metaphor in general for academia and institutions of higher learning. It's just a useful metaphor that you can picture an actual place that is a citadel or even a monastery, if you will, a castle. A place where the elites are, where the rest of us are outside of it, because they seem to have that sort of an attitude.
Now, you kind of have an interesting background, so I kind of want to get to a little bit about your journey. So what has your political and social journey been to where you are today?
Oh, boy. I guess we could go back to the small Christian schools I went to as a child. None of it made any sense to me. I was always a very questioning and questing kind of a person. So I guess that turned me into a rebellious intellectual, and that theme continued all through college. It wasn't until after my master's degree that I started getting political, if you will. And basically, it's because the world started to lose its collective mind, and I felt like I had to address that rather than hanging out with my medieval tomes and grimoires. It seemed a little more important to deal with what was actually going on in the world. And when you keep your head in a book like that, it's kind of the same as sticking your head in the sand.
You had mentioned some Satanist writers. Do you think that some of your interest in some of that is a rebellion from your Christian roots?
Oh, yes. A little bit of that? Absolutely, yeah. It is. Yeah. That was my nickname in high school, was Satan. But you know what? Fine. Let's just go with it. Just went with it. You know, it kept the annoying children away from me, so I just kind of embraced it.
I heard there's actually a whole group. I think it's called the Joy of Satan. A big forum, and there's actually quite a few pro-whites in there. I just learned about this not too long ago. Do you know anything about that?
Not much. I try to kind of keep to myself. Yeah. I don't socialize a whole lot. So I've heard of it, but I have not gotten involved at all.
Well, you've written 3 books, so you had tell us about what those titles are and share the themes of these books.
Well, I just happen to have them right here.
Great.
The first one is Condemnation. You see, yeah, there it is. This one's about a modern-day Joan of Arc. Her name is Joan Archer. And rather than riding her horse, she has a Harley. That's why I started working at the Harley shop, so I could get to know the biker lingo and the biker world. And she goes from Atlanta to New Orleans and basically stops a biker war. And her sidekick is Bluebeard, because that's one of her generals, historically speaking. And they get into all sorts of trouble, and then she ends up dead, of course. Spoiler alert, but we knew that already. And he goes on a rampage, and rather than getting into necromancy as he did in the 15th century, he gets into voodoo. And the book ends with his execution as well. So it parallels the history of Joan of Arc and Bluebeard, but it's set today. And that's the first one. The second one is Godless. It's right here. And that's a spinoff of the first one. I've got this crazy hair. There's a young girl at the end of Condemnation who is almost murdered by Bluebeard. He tries to kill her. He fails. She survives. She ends up in a mental institution. And she is reading about a 17th century witch trial where there was an entire convent of nuns possessed. And the priest was put on trial and burned for their possession. And she gets her inquisitors and her doctors confused. So it's like she gets the centuries mixed up, which honestly, modern psychiatry is a whole lot like the Inquisition. That's kind of the point I made with that book. And the third one that's out is The Twisted Rib. That one is also a spinoff story. One of the girls who rides with the biker gang in the first book gets a job at a whorehouse outside of New Orleans. Only it's not a regular whorehouse. It's kind of a mystical, holy kind of a whorehouse. In Celtic mythology, you have a place known as the Hallows. It's the in-between realms, and that's where the whorehouse is. So only people who are spiritually meant to be there can find it. And the characters are the bad girls, if you will, from the Bible. It goes backwards from Mary Magdalene to Lilith.
Yeah, you focus on a lot of female leads. So how do they really differ from a lot of the modern female feminist-driven roles we see so much in movies books today?
I guess my women are different in that they have this overarching sense of moral duty, whether it's spiritual, political, social, or whatever. It's beyond their personal selves. And a lot of feminists I see today are very self-centered and selfish, childish. They don't think past one generation, which is their own. And I don't think that's a good idea at all. So my characters are, I guess they have a mission from God, if you will, and that's what they're about. It's not about them at all.
Now, what are your thoughts on feminism today?
Oh, God, that's just a horrible subject. I don't like it, honestly. There was a time when feminism was very necessary. Because women, they should have choices. Women should have choices. And there was a time when they didn't. So there was a need for feminism. But it's gone way, way, way too far. A personal story, a few years ago, an elderly woman whose husband had just died pulled me aside and told me that she was relieved that he was dead. This woman has 8 children, several miscarriages, and she didn't want any of it. She wanted to go to college, and she never had that choice. And she was happy that her husband was dead. She didn't want her family to know, so I'm not going to say who it was. But that story tells you that we definitely needed feminism, but to go from that to running around in the streets, waving dildos and screaming about your vagina and wearing a t-shirt that says how many abortions you've had has just gone way, way, way too far.
Yeah, well, in the case of that woman, then she should have just not got married or had kids. I guess she could have not done
it. She shouldn't have, but that's where you get religious oppression. It was God's will. He convinced her. Her husband said it was God's will that you have all these children, and she bought into it, and that was the end of it for her.
So are you still in that Christian paradigm, or did you actually break out of that?
No. I've never been in it.
Yeah, you just grew up in it, so it affected you quite a bit.
My parents sent me to private school because the public schools were no good. That was pretty much the only reason, but we never really went to church. So I was always an outsider. And I appreciate that perspective. I got to know Christianity, I guess, from a perspective where you could see what was really going on rather than being involved in it directly.
Now, thinking in terms of modern society, I know you're a critic. We share a lot of similar views now. So what is your critique of modern society, things that you don't like?
There's a lot that I don't like. I guess it's going to sound hypocritical given what we're doing, but technology is a huge problem, I think, for people. I went jogging downtown not too long ago. I was in the business district, and it was like they were filming The Walking Dead or something. I'm looking around. Everyone is, they're in their nice business clothes, but they are all completely miserable. They're just shuffling around with a screen in their face and giving me dirty looks because I'm out enjoying my life and I don't have a screen in my face. And I thought, that's just really sad. And I worked at a preschool when my kids were really young, and we would have the parents complaining that they don't see their kids enough, which is true. But when you're driving the Mercedes and you have 2 houses and you have a boat and you have all this and you're complaining that you can't take care of your kids because you have to pay the bills, then you might be a little too materialistic. And that's another huge problem with society. Everybody wants the things. They want this, that, and the other, and they don't seem to understand how it affects them emotionally.
Now, what about politically and thinking in terms of Trump and everything that's going on? Are you a fan of that or not a fan of Trump?
I think he has the potential to do a lot of good, and I hope that he does. With the population acting the way it is, I don't know that he's going to be allowed to do any good. Everyone seems to be determined to sabotage him, and I hope that ends. He's only been the president for, a few weeks now? So I'm hoping things calm down, but I'm not sure. It could get worse before it gets better, but I wish him all the best. He's inherited a gigantic mess.
Now, what do you think about the current state of Western society? Obviously, I mean, it's being destroyed. What are some of the root causes you think we can point to for that?
The root cause, I would go all the way back to monotheism in general, in and of itself. I would say that was a huge root cause of what's going on in the West, and it's just a giant problem. If you read Genesis, just those first few chapters, it tells you that this planet is yours. You can do what you please. Because guess what? You're temporary. This is a temporary home, and you get to go to heaven at some point. That is a recipe for disaster, and it's present in all 3 of the monotheistic faiths. And I think that is a huge root problem of what's going on in the world right now. And of course, that root has branched off in several different directions. One of those directions leads from the Torah to the Talmud. And if you read that, you read all sorts of not so pleasant things about not only owning the planet's natural resources and everything here, you own the people who are not the same as you. There is quite a bit of historical evidence that I won't get into right now that shows that a faction of society took that to heart and has acted accordingly. A couple of examples might be like the Frankfurt School of Cultural Marxism, that sort of thing. Another branch from that same very rotten root is the masochism that is so obvious in Christianity. You get the I'm not worthy, uses the whole forgive me's and so on. It's absolute rubbish, and it will destroy Europe if we let it. It's, in my opinion, that's just psyops and crowd control at its finest. And the result we see today is an emasculated society. we're ripe for conquest if we don't, and forgive me for saying it, if we don't take our collective balls down from the cross and stop acting so wimpy. But we're taught to be passive, to turn the other cheek, and that if you live by the sword, you die by the sword. Whereas conversely, Islam is taught that you do live by the sword. In fact, you convert by the sword. So in a very oversimplified nutshell, you have Jewish politics that encourages Muslim immigration into very passive Christian lands, and bam, you have chaos. And I know it's infinitely more complicated than that. It's a Gordian knot, actually, but maybe what we need is a pagan hero to come in and slice the whole thing to bits. Who knows?
Now, looking around in Europe today, most of them aren't Christians anymore. Western Europe, Northern Europe. But do you think that Christian influence has still kind of been there?
It's
infected
it's so
liberalism?
Ingrained. Yeah. Right. I think it's so ingrained in who we are that it's going to take a few centuries to shake that off. It's also the whole white guilt idea, which builds off of the Christian masochism. We were just ready for that sort of thing, which is unfortunate because it's not earned.
I guess one of the other negative things when comparing paganism versus Christianity is that Christianity has been more global, right? Everyone can be a part of it, whereas paganism was more based on tribes and kind of an ethno-religion, if you will.
Yes, and now we're taught that tribalism is bad, especially if you're white. You can't stick to your own people, you can't help your own people, or you get called a racist.
You're working on a presentation about witch hunts, and I also view, you know, liberals, basically what they're doing today, how they're, you know, hunting white right-wingers as kind of like a modern-day puritanical witch hunt. So do you see parallels between the Salem witch trials with today's lefties?
Absolutely, and I wouldn't just say Salem. I would say the witch trials in general all across Europe and here in New England. What we have in this society now, as opposed to the religious stupor that they had in the Middle Ages, is a pill popper society. Everybody seems to be on something, and if they're not on actual medication, they're in some sort of tech slumber. People just aren't clear. Their minds aren't clear. They're fuzzy, which means they're easily manipulated, they're easily controlled, and they're pliable. And that's the kind of citizens that a lot of people on the left seem to want. The crowds aren't pointing and screaming witch anymore. They're pointing and screaming Nazi or fascist, racist, bigot, pick a label. It doesn't really matter. Either way, the crowd just seems to need a victim. And that translates well into the Nuremberg trials, which I've been reading a lot about lately. It was an absolute farce of a trial, and you could easily compare it to the most notorious witch burnings. Today, of course, it isn't about some 17th century priest that allegedly causes a convent possession. I mean, today we would laugh about that. But now what we have are thought, it's probably even worse what we have now. We have thought crimes that are manifesting as flesh and blood assaults. The more you scream racist, the more racism you create. And I don't think people realize that. But that's definitely what I see going on around me. Very passive people have become almost violent because they feel like they have to defend themselves from these ridiculous accusations. It reminds me of a passage I read in a book called Gods of War. It's written by a former SS soldier, and he was in a denazification camp after the war, and one of the guys he was with was a pilot, and this pilot was not a Nazi. He was not a member of the National Socialist Party. He was not an SS soldier. He was just some guy who got drafted into the war. But of course, they're interrogating him every day. Are you a Nazi? Are you a Nazi? Are you a Nazi? Over and over again. And he finally said, I'm not a Nazi, but I am becoming one right now.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I feel.
Yeah.
You know, when people yell Nazi at you, like, no, but maybe that's a good idea.
Yeah. I hear people saying it all the time.
Where it's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. The left is creating Nazis. Yeah.
They don't seem to even know what the word means. But we know a lot more about Nuremberg and the trials and World War II in general now. And that knowledge, I think, is our power. Because we can disarm those words that they throw against us constantly.
Do you think by people being called fascist and Nazi nonstop that maybe more people are going to begin to actually look in that period of history and be curious about, what actually was a Nazi and a fascist?
Right. I think that they already have. I've noticed just I sell books. That's what I do. I work at a bookstore, and I get a lot of the publishing insider magazines. It's interesting, the books that have gone up in sales tremendously since Trump was elected. And there's a lot about fascism, a lot about World War II, a lot about totalitarianism. It's very interesting to see what's going on, just from a book buyer's perspective.
And I noticed fascism, too, is one of those terms that's been very hard for people to define. And a lot of times you see these cucks on the ride who use it just to call out these, you know, Antifa protesters. They call them fascists. And it's like, no, they're actually the exact opposite of fascists, you know. Communists and fascists are like mortal enemies here.
True. Very true. If you'd like, I can read a little bit out of the next book that I'm working on. This is going to be a very political book for me. The other ones were more philosophical, but quite frankly, I'm mad. And I changed the tone of this book when I started writing. It was originally supposed to be about the fine line between a saint and a witch. And I had two late medieval examples that I was going to talk about. But given all that's going on in the world right now, I kind of turned it into a very prolonged tantrum. But the character is going on a road trip. She was actually friends with Joan Archer in the first book. And after Joan dies, she goes on a road trip. And this book that I'm working on now is her road trip. So it's a novel, but it's also just simply her interactions with people. And a lot of these interactions have been mine. Just because I go out on foot. I don't even have a car. I'm out on foot all the time. I talk to people. So a lot of the stories and interactions that she has with people in here actually happened to me. So I thought, well, you know what? I may as well just turn that into a book with everything that's going on in the world right now. It might be time for it. But she kind of had a little tantrum about the Nuremberg trials that I could read to you if you'd like.
Yeah, go for it. Let's hear it.
Okay. The witch hunts were absolute horrors and the trials a travesty of justice, but we know that now. And Nuremberg, when will we classify that farce as a show trial, nothing more? Soon, for one can only push down the truth for so long. It always surfaces, even if downstream. We know the Nazi defendants were tortured, even permanently maimed, to extract confessions. We also know that confessions obtained under torture are not reliable. We know documents were forged. We know defense attorneys weren't allowed to admit mountains of evidence. We know a certain narrative had to be fed to a hungry public, and so it was. Perhaps the most glaring truths are the war crimes committed by the Allies, swept under a proverbial rug by every 1950s housewife. With time, all those rotting German corpses have begun to stink and can be hidden no longer. As many historians have said, the truth will out. These historians, of course, are rejected, even fined and arrested. But why? So many questions, and they had the nerve to ask them. That's why. When it's a crime to even ask a question about a historical event, as any historian would any other historical event, one should be suspicious. Why? What is so disconcerting about the understory of World War II that we must forever leave these events shrouded in a sacrosanct darkness? Are the horrors of Auschwitz really so terrible to contemplate? Perhaps the reverse is true. Perhaps the horrors weren't so horrible. When it's bad news that less people were killed, something is amiss. And so there are questions. So many questions. We were supposed to find answers at Nuremberg, and we did, but only those answers that fit a preconceived narrative. All else was inadmissible. Archives have been opened to the public since the trial, and the inquisitive can now trace the motives of these Allied investigators. What we see is not flattering. There are even records stating that all the records should be destroyed. When purveyors of justice have sufficient motive for destroying records, something is amiss. On December 10, 1948, the United Nations declared that the retroactive application of criminal law was a violation of human rights. In other words, if the law did not yet exist at the time of a crime, one could not be prosecuted under that law. Such a tenet seems so glaringly obvious, but it wasn't at Nuremberg, where defendants were handpicked, then laws drafted, that the chosen criminals were condemned for breaking. This was unjust at best, but it was politics as usual in the upper echelons of corruption. When new laws are written solely to create criminals deemed guilty before a trial begins, something is amiss. Yes, something was amiss at Nuremberg. It was a mistrial, a miscarriage of justice, a mistake. To the Allies staging the trial, it was appeasement, empty calories fed to a hungry public who knew only that unspeakable things had happened and someone had to pay. What an eager audience this public was, lapping up propaganda like well-trained dogs. Are we any different now? That was her rant about that. It goes on and on, but I'll spare you.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen footage from the trials, and it's just unbelievable what happens there. It's just it's a joke. If people haven't seen it, they actually need to watch that. It's very telling. And some people were forced to recant under threat. They were threatening to, you know, kill families.
Oh, they were tortured, like really sincerely tortured. And anybody who's studying the witch trials knows that you can only torture somebody so much. They're going to tell you anything you want to hear.
And what about their evidence? What evidence did they present?
They didn't really have any.
No, they didn't.
They had forged documents that we know were forged. They had hearsay. They had gossip. They had the confessions extracted under torture. None of that would be admissible in, just say, an average murder trial today. It just wouldn't fly.
Now, this period of history, though, is just so ingrained in people's heads. It's like they don't even go to look in that period of history anymore. They're almost, their mind's already made up.
There's a smoke screen.
But there's a lot of people like you and I, and I've meeting people left and right all the time who are researching this period of history and are like, wow, I had no idea all these things, and it's coming out. Do you think that it's even possible that something like this can seep into the mainstream, considering all the anti-Nazi, anti-Hitler propaganda that's forced into us from a young age? I mean, we all learn about the Holocaust around the world, basically.
Right. You know? I think it's possible, and I think it's happening, and perhaps that's part of the reason for the backlash, is people know that the truth is slowly leaking out, and they're panicking. But that maybe that's an overly optimistic view of things, but I definitely think that you can't hide the truth forever. It's going to come out. It's going to surface.
Yeah, and a good thing to tell people who are normies, who are, you know, against looking into this period of history, is like, okay, well, why does the truth have to be protected by law then? Why do people go to prison for questioning this particular event? That should be a huge red flag. I mean, that's what got me to question and look into it. Why are people going to prison for questioning and looking into this period of history? Why is there, you know, so much, you know, no taboo around this area? So of course it's going to make more people want to go look into it.
Definitely. Absolutely.
So what do you think can be done to fight back against a lot of these modern day witch hunts? Because it's back. The Inquisition is back, and they're lefties that are, you know, trannies and gays and feminists and people preaching about diversity, but they're an Inquisition.
Oh, absolutely. I think building on what we talked about before, when you know the past, when you have that knowledge, that is your power. For example, if you know beforehand that someone is about to tell you a lie, you're obviously not going to fall for it. You're not going to believe them. So if someone throws down a victim card and says, you can't say, think, or do this or that because of event X, well, but you know their so-called event X was actually more of an event Y, they have lost their power. So simply knowing what really happened stops a lot of arguments. And also, if you take these words and just turn them back around on them, they can't use them against you. So if you don't care if somebody calls you a racist or a Nazi, they're going to stop eventually. One would hope.
Yeah, it loses its power. It loses its grip.
It absolutely loses its power.
Right now, basically, the left calls everybody a Nazi. They call Trump a Nazi, for crying out loud.
I've been called a Nazi.
Yeah, I mean,
why?
Pretty much any standard Republican now is being called a Nazi. So it's just it's losing its meaning altogether.
It loses its meaning, but I also think we can add to its demise, if you will, by just simply redefining the word. And there's concrete historical examples. I'm gonna read a little more of the book to you. We must ask, what does it mean to be a Nazi? The Nazis saw themselves as a shield between Bolshevism and the rest of Europe. Remember, before the Iron Curtain and the Cold War, we were allies with the Red Monster and didn't fully understand the extent of the communist crimes. Germany did. They were nearly taken over themselves and saw firsthand what the Russian had been reduced to under the Bolshevik boot. Europe could not fall to this horror, and so the Nazi put himself between the Red Terror and the rest of the Western world. Is that what it means to be a Nazi? You can say things like that when they call you a Nazi, and it really throws people off. But just keep going. Who qualifies as a Nazi? What about the lost little boy wandering the war-ravaged countryside with his four-year-old sister begging Americans for food? When asked about his family, he numbly replied that grandma and grandpa were dead and mommy was lost. Was Daddy a dead Nazi blown to bits somewhere nearby? Is the whole family guilty of the Heil? Maybe they were all Nazis. Maybe those lost and hungry children got what they deserved. What about both the German soldier and civilian fighting to the bitter end on the brutal Eastern Front? Everywhere stained with rape, torture, and murder, encouraged by commissars who were largely Jewish, as well as propaganda fed to them by the hate monger Ilya Ehrenberg, screaming, "Kill, kill, kill, take the German woman as your lawful booty. Is it all right to rape a woman to death if she qualifies as a Nazi?" The Führer didn't think so, and he ranted and raved in desperation to stop the Red Terror from raping all of Europe. Hitler vowed to protect the dignity of the West. Is that what it means to be a Nazi? Maybe the soldiers were all Nazis. These were young men drafted into a war beyond their control, captured, jailed, and tortured. They were beaten severely, starved, dehydrated, chained, and forced to stand until they collapsed. Cigarettes were put out in their mouths, which they then had to eat. They were pressed against burning radiators, crowded into small cells, kept at extremely high temperatures. They were only fed sparingly foods, highly spiced with salt, pepper, and mustard to make their thirst unbearable, and they were not allowed to sleep for days. This is the condition they were brought to trial in. This is what they were reduced to before the question, "Are you a Nazi?" Many said yes to stop the torture. Is that what it means to be a Nazi? So the next time somebody tells you a Nazi, ask them what they mean by that, and maybe throw down some historical examples of the not-so-bad Nazis.
And also when they say you're a Nazi, and you're a communist, so what's your point? We can't get along.
Right.
You know, we're mortal enemies here, so let's just separate. But they don't want that, do they? They don't want to separate. They want to be in our space, dictating, telling us what to do, mass murdering so-called Nazis. I mean, right? They don't want to separate.
No. Absolutely not. It's, I guess I would call it hypocrisy at its finest. They do exactly what they accuse others of doing. And it's almost like, hey, look over there. Don't watch us. Because we're doing what we're accusing you of doing. We don't want you to know. It's all very bizarre what's going on right now.
Well, thinking in terms of mindset, what is the best mindset, the best approach, do you think, to combat leftist totalitarianism? What's the best tactic?
You know, when I think about that, I can't help but think, my son's going to kill me. I think of him, he's on a rugby team, and he's a very big boy, and I've seen him run with two or three other guys just hanging off of him. And that's kind of what you have to do with these leftists who want to insult you, is just keep going. Just keep going. Just plow through them and keep going. Do what you have to do. And if they, you know, just get the score, get the touchdown, let them try to drag you down, but they can't.
Well, also switching subject, I know that there's a large sect of pro-whites who are in the occult and the left-hand path,
right.
Luciferianism, but then we also have a large group of, you know, pagans and Christians and atheists. We really are a truly diverse bunch when it comes to spiritual interests, which I think is good. It's good that we're actually tolerant of that. We even have transhumanists in the mix. So
I don't even know what that means.
So where do you fit into the mix?
You know, I'm honestly not sure. I guess I kind of got on the left-hand path, so to speak, because no one else would have me. The Satanists and such are the only people I don't seem to scare to death. So that's kind of how I ended up there. But I don't identify as a Satanist, a Luciferian, or anything like that. I guess if I had to define myself, I would be a very informal pagan. I don't necessarily do the rituals the way they say you're supposed to. I don't necessarily even do rituals. That kind of goes back to the whole antinomian idea that I have in my author bio. It's antinomian means against the law. And what that meant for a medieval mystic, for instance, was you didn't have to follow the laws of the church. You could kind of do your own thing. A lot of these saints and even some of the heretics that were burned for it felt like they were on a mission. They had this job to do. They were here just to accomplish this or that, and they didn't have to follow the church rules. They were going to talk to God themselves, say, instead of getting the priest to do it for them. And that's kind of the idea with my religiosity. I guess you could say I don't really follow the rules because I have work to do. And a lot of it's quite silly, honestly.
When it comes to Satanism, though, it's still in the same paradigm, though, really, of monotheism and Christianity, right? Of the Abrahamic religions.
Levian Satanism is. Levian Satanism is atheistic, but like any religion, Satanism splintered, people started fighting. And so there's a whole variety of Satanists out there now. And you never know what you're dealing with. You just kind of have to ask them.
And then how do they differ from the Luciferians?
I think the Luciferians, I would say, are a little more on the philosophical side of things, in that Lucifer is almost a Promethean figure. So he's bringing knowledge to humans and hence has the bad reputation that he has. But Satanists are a little more, I guess, mainstream and out there in the public view. Luciferians tend to be a lot more quiet and keep to themselves.
Any Satanists I've come across have actually all been liberals. You know, they're still like into diversity.
Yeah, they're pretty liberal and they like to get attention.
I don't know.
Luciferians aren't quite like that, I don't think. But that's, you know, I've had a limited experience because I tend to stay in my room and write books.
Now, you mentioned the left-hand path. So for people that have never heard that, what does that mean? What is the left-hand path?
I guess, funny enough, a very good definition of what the left-hand path is can be found in the Gospel of Matthew, of all places. It's that verse, I don't know the exact way it's worded, but there's thousands of translations at this point, so it doesn't really matter. He talks about the way to salvation being narrow and difficult and arduous, but the way to damnation is wide open and comfortable. I kind of see that in a similar light with the left-hand path. It's going to be a little more narrow and difficult, whereas your right-hand people like Christianity, the big three religions, even the love and light pagan group is going to be on the wide, comfortable path. It's more mainstream. It's more accepted by society. It's a little easier to get along.
Now, there are a lot of people like us that think like us, a lot of pro-whites that call themselves pagan, and there's a lot of people that have, there's a lot of misunderstandings about what they think that is. They think, you know, the term LARPing comes into play. They think we go dress up and role play. So what does it mean to you when you say, I'm a pagan?
It means I would adhere to older gods, and I don't like monotheism. I think it's very, very bad for people, very bad for the planet. I am not a formal pagan, and then I don't stick to this one pantheon as opposed to another pantheon. My degree is actually in religious studies, so I like religion. I like studying different gods, and some of them I like more than others. It's pretty much that simple.
Yeah, the other aspect of paganism, and thinking in terms of Europe and in Scandinavia and Eastern Europe, it's about being in touch with the earth's natural cycles and honoring,
right,
you know, fertility and the change in season. It's as grounded as you can be, I think. It's not just a fairy tale guy in the sky all the time. It's very grounded. It's based on blood and soil and land, right?
And that kind of brings it back to the whole left-hand path idea, whereas people that are on the left-hand path don't have a problem with the darker side of religion. You have destruction as well as creation. You have to have both. You have to have winter. You have to have summer. You have dark. You have light. You have good. You have bad. You have male and female. It's about balance. And a lot of the more mainstream religions don't want to acknowledge the darker side of things. But I think a healthier view is to acknowledge the beast within, if you will. And that's just a much healthier attitude to have. You can't just focus all on the happy stuff and pretend the bad stuff isn't there.
That's right. That's right. And also, I think ritual is important. Europeans need that. We need to remember some of the old rituals are. I did a video on Christmas and the you know, Nordic origins, actually.
Yes,
Yule. So people are doing these rituals without knowing it. It's important to know where these rituals came from, and I think resurrect even some old ones. I mean, Easter's another one, for instance. You know, Halloween. All these things actually do come from pagan aspects of European culture. So it's good to know what those actually are and honor them for what they are, because that's what our ancestors did. So you get more in touch with them when you go through these rituals, through these motions, I think.
Ritual and tradition is good so long as you are conscious of what you are doing. So many people fall into the trap where they're just, with their rosaries. They're just mindlessly going through the motions. They're not actually thinking about what they're doing. They're just doing it. It's repetitious. So I think if you're going to get into rituals and traditions, you need to be conscious of what you are doing and actually be present in it and not just zone out.
Also, you're a mother. So are you raising your kids kind of with some pagan aspects, or how are you raising them? Are you teaching them about things in the world?
Funny
right
enough,
now?
Their grandpa, my ex-father-in-law, is a pastor. He's a Seventh-day Adventist pastor, and he's constantly trying to get them to get baptized, and they're constantly telling him to go away. It's been kind of awkward, but it's kind of funny at the same time. I hate to say that, but I didn't raise them to be this, that, or the other. I raised them to think for themselves, and I exposed them to several different sources, different books they've been reading since they were tiny, tiny little things. And I want them to know that they have a mind of their own and they can make up their own mind.
Now, what are you doing to help them remember or know what their European culture is, your ancestry, or that we came from Europe? What are some things that you do for your children so that they, you know, are rooted in their European past?
Well, you just mentioned all the Yule and Christmas traditions. That wasn't too long ago. We actually looked up some old Scandinavian recipes. We made some cookies. We talked about the way they used to decorate and where different Christmas traditions that we call Christian now actually came from. And I pretty much do that with every holiday. Every holiday we end up in the kitchen, of course. But that's a good way to teach your kids about where they come from. We also do, just as far as local history goes, we go on history hikes. I don't live too far from Kennesaw Mountain, and there was a huge Civil War battle there. So I will take, it probably drives them crazy, but I'll take notes with us and read them stories of what actually happened while we were there in the place where it happened.
Nice.
And it just so happens that their uncle, their great uncle on my mother's side, was the general at that battle. So we kind of have a personal interest in it as well.
Very nice.
But we go all over Atlanta and just say, okay, what happened here in this spot? This is where your uncle watched Atlanta burn. So it's kind of cool to stand in the same place.
Now, has your family been in America for a long time?
I believe it was sometime in the 1600s that the first ancestor came over from northern Spain. He was a criminal. He escaped from some prison and stowed away on a cargo ship. I come from criminals. That's my mom's side of the family. My dad's side was a little different. They were largely indentured servants. Northern European indentured servants.
Oh, really? Well, that's good. Your family passes down that memory. Yeah, indentured servants lived in worse conditions than slaves.
Right.
People listening should check out the Red Ice interview with Michael Hoffman. It was called The Untold History of the Enslavement of Whites in Early America. It's a really good one. We've heard from a lot of listeners who say that their families were slaves. I think it's important to pass down this history to remember what your ancestors went through to get here.
Yeah, they passed down stories. My grandfather told me when he was just a baby, his mother actually raised some of the black kids because their mother died giving birth, and she had given birth like the same week. So she nursed their babies, and they were all ridiculously poor on the same farm together. And he had this wonderful saying, it didn't matter what color your skin was. The only color that mattered was green. And that was the green in your pocket and the green in your fields. That's really the only color that ever mattered to them.
Yeah, that's
so
just
when
it.
People scream racism, I'm like, do you even know what you're talking about?
Yeah, slavery was all about the money. They didn't care what color people were.
No, it just so happened that Africans were a hell of a lot tougher than Irish people when you put them in
the sun.
Very, very sunny environment like the American South or even the Caribbean.
Yeah.
White people were just dropping like flies.
Because the Irish slaves, they burned. That's where a lot of the redneck term comes from, actually. It was put down to slaves.
How do you get a redneck? You're bent over working.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. Awful. Well, tell us about the work you're doing at Revolutionary Conservative. What does Augustus have going on over there? I know you've been doing some articles.
Right. We've got a lot going on there. I'm writing articles for the Federal Reserve Division, Education, and Immigration. Within immigration, I mainly focus on multiculturalism because I think that's a lot of nonsense. But we just got the site started, so there's not a whole lot up just yet. But it's building every day, and it's getting better and better, and I urge you to go and check it out. We've got some interesting projects coming up. We're actually, some people are heading over to Europe to document what's going on over there. And you can go to our website and donate to that. And there's a lot of good reading to be had. There's several authors, not just me. We all are on this sinking ship together, and we need to try to do something about it before it's too late.
And tell people how they can get a hold of your book. I think it's just on Amazon at this point, right?
It is on Amazon. I'm self-published, but you can check it out there. And it's Rachel Summers. There's another Rachel Summers that writes these horrible romance novels.
Yeah, there's a lot of Rachel Summers on Amazon.
Not happy about that at all. But I've got the three books that I showed you, and hopefully the fourth one will be out. I'm shooting for the fall equinox.
All right. Well, thank you, Rachel, for being a guest. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. It was good to talk to you.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We have many more new and interesting guests lined up, so be sure to check redice.tv for the latest. If you like this show and other shows we produce, help support us by signing up for a Red Ice membership at redicemembers.com. And don't miss our live TV show on Saturdays called Weekend Warrior. It starts at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 p.m. Central European Time, available for Red Ice members. That's it for now. So until next time, have a good night. Thank you.